The ACN podcast is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners and sponsors, including the Agile Alliance. As a nonprofit membership organization, the Agile Alliance is an excellent resource to help you along your Agile journey. To learn more about the Agile Alliance and our other sponsors, as well as how you can become a sponsor or supporter of our show, please visit acnpodcast.org for more information. And thank you for your support. Good morning and good evening, everyone. This is the Agile Coaching Network. The Agile Coaching Network, if this is your first time joining us, is brought to you by the Agile Alliance. Agile Alliance is a nonprofit organization that started at the birth of the Agile Manifesto way back in the dawn of time. I'm not sure if it was the dawn of time, but for some of you, 2001 could be the dawn of time. The Agile Alliance, if you don't know who we are as an organization, we do a lot of member-run events, including running the big, the big Agile conference that happened virtually this year, just because of the world situation with COVID. But, we do a lot of just mission work as well. So if you get a chance to go to agilealliance.org, look at some of the member-run initiatives and the programs that we're doing in order to help to improve Agile and Agile development, and just overall just improve the way of work and how we approach our jobs more effectively and hopefully build a more effective, humane, and sustainable way of working. Go give them a look. The actual membership itself for an individual is relatively cheap for the value that you get. I mean, the number of discounts that you get with your membership, as an example, we've got Agile Testing Days that's going to be happening over in Germany. I know there's a big discount for Agile Alliance members there. And then we just have all these monthly different events that are happening that are on the member-only side. In order to take advantage of them, you need to just, drop your $49 to go do that. And that, to be honest with you, we lowered the price at the beginning of the year because we knew that that would make it more accessible and make it a personal choice or decision. Also, there are corporate memberships that are available. I'd like to welcome Boeing, and hopefully some Boeing people are joining us this month on the Agile Coaching Network. Boeing is, as you might have known, has been doing some Agile development internally, but they're stepping up their game. I know that they're doing some hiring as well. So if you want to go look at an Agile career at Boeing, why don't you go give them a look on their website. I'm joined with a cast of regulars. We couldn't come up with a better name other than just we are the conversation starters. The Agile Coaching Network is ran in a particular way that it's not a general panel where, it's just a bunch of experts or, those of us, gray hairs, in my case, no hair, just up here talking for a long period of time. I think occasionally people nudge me to not talk so much, but overall, what our goal is to get this entire audience talking about the subject matter that's here. And that's regardless if you are 10 years into Agile, 20 years into Agile, we want to hear that perspective, but we also want to hear the perspective of you, the new person who is just getting involved with Agile and Agile development. I think you provide a contrast. You provide some of us who've been doing it for a long period of time. You kind of trigger the oh yeah sensors in our brain, which is, oh yeah, I remember we tried that or we did that. By no means though, this community, the one reason why I love the Agile community is the fact that we like to give and share. So the volunteers that come every month here, which is, Shauna, Hendrik, Jorg, Diana, all of them, I appreciate their volunteership that they do for us. And they also provide some pretty good comments to get us going on whatever subject matter we're talking about. So to kick things off, I was having, as I do monthly conversations, and I mine Twitter for different things, but I was stumbling across, which I think is one of the more, I don't know, it's sort of the vaguer kind of big fluffy statement that we do in the Agile principle that says that, continuous attention to technical excellence and good design enhances agility. And for most of us who've been, thinking about Agile as a word, sometimes it gets confused with speed versus the ability to pivot or the ability to swarm on something quickly. And if you've been a part of technical projects as much as I have, I've seen multiple projects where when we say that this most simple fix, which we think perceivably would be the most simple fix, gets caught by technical debt or gets caught by some level of complexity of the system. So something that you would think might take days is now going to cost us weeks in order to go and develop and do. And I know that most organizations, as they're starting off with Agile, they're not just dealing with the vector of how do I get humans to work together more effectively. We're also dealing with the complexities of a very big technical blob, which is the project that we have. So we're actually transforming several things. We're transforming the way people work together, and we're transforming the code base or whatever the product that we're working on. It doesn't have to be software, but we're looking at it in a way that we can start to be able to effectively develop and not push up against the technical debt that we've had for years. And there's a lot of technical debt models and ways to calculate it and other things. That's not what the point of what I'm trying to get to today is. Just we know that technical debt slows us down. Technical debt also has some other artifacts as well, which is if you think from a pressure to increase your productivity, that tends to be some of the background of how do we, if you think of management's view of Agile or management's view of things, or even our own personal wanting to be able to get more to our customers or higher value to our customers, we push up against that technical debt as well. And technical debt, if you go into it, it's a combination of low quality of your code, but it also is the combination of a self-feeding, a set of just maybe I did a quick fix in order to get me past this one particular issue, but I cascaded that where it sort of blocked or slowed down other things. And then therefore productivity gets halted basically because of that. In the olden days, if you think about the relationship we used to have between users and engineers, is that the complexity used to be mostly on the side of the user. If anyone can remember having to go take a class in a piece of software, that was common back in the 1980s and 90s. You basically were getting a PhD in Excel or a PhD in whatever application that you were learning. That complexity was pushed off to the user. In the new world, in the mobile world, we've actually had that switch where now design is the holders of the complexity, and we've simplified user interfaces and made software a better experience overall for the end user to make it more consumable. But that, again, is the second portion of this, which is not just the technical debt, but just the complexity or the weight of what we're dealing with and what we're developing as well. Those things come into play. So the kickoff question today is this continuous attention to technical excellence and good design, and all for the whole purpose of improving agility of the organization. I'd like to know from all of your experience, how do you approach this in your teams? And then also as a follow-up question to that is, what is in your go-to tools and methods that you use in order for this particular principle to come in existence in your teams? And to kick us off, let's see, York, do you want to give a start off for this?
Yes, I can start this one off. So things I do is, first of all, make it explicit and transparent where we are, whichever team I'm starting with. The interesting thing is, what have you done in the past? What do you need to do? What are your main obstacles, challenges to get this discussion going in a constructive way? Because first thing is acknowledge that you will have that technical debt, which means if you make a commitment, it's probably more precise because it at least takes the possibility of delay into account. And so you gain some room to not accumulate more technical debt. And then in small steps, make commitments to remove it to get to more excellence, depending on the situation. So simple things are definitely peer reviews of whatever you do. Bring at least four eyes onto the subject before the major work is done, and definitely afterwards, but both before and after is important, because that gives you an expectation of what happens that you then can contrast to what really happened. Second thing I'm trying to do is, especially on the technical stuff, to go to very short learning cycles after the solution of the problem, so that you really can still remember what you technically did, what was painful and what was helpful, to amplify the helpful things and dampen the less helpful things in the direct discussion. Because if you wait and you get feedback that you're fixed or whatever is left by the customer, you forget a lot of the painful things. And if it didn't fix the customer problem, you forget a lot of the helpful things. So keep that cycle short and early. That's extremely important. And the other thing is, I'm always trying to take the tools from the team, not to push it to them. Most often they come up with the best solutions if they know that it matters and that I'm interested as a team lead in getting this thing solved, and I'm willing to invest time and thought. And then they will most often come up with something that I didn't even see. So that's my first thing. There is really curiosity, acknowledging what is there, and then the curiosity, how do you think we can improve? And the interesting thing is, people at one point will not notice that they removed obstacles. They will only mourn that they haven't yet reached perfection. And then that's the very important tool to keep this going for a long time. Always remind them that they already did steps before. And they're just continuing on the way. They are not starting at a bad place, but they start being on a journey. And that matters a lot here, because if you do it only as emergency events or change events or whatever, and not continuously, then it will always have a starting motivation, then a failing motivation, then a catastrophe, then a restart. Leaps and bounds are not really going to take you anywhere.
Sure. Those are all good points. Shana, what do you have?
Yeah, this is definitely something that I'm passionate about. There are really three things that I like to think of in terms of technical debt. The first one is, you know, you'll hear teams talk a lot about build quality in, or terms like shift left, test-driven development. I think that it's really about changing the culture of how teams build software. I'm very passionate about using a Kanban workflow for my teams, because you kind of have each step of the flow broken down. So one of the things that I think is really good is not just to have it something like a definition of done, but create a definition of ready in order. So what does it take in order for something to be ready for the next column? And so in the workflow, so what I like to do is, like, you know, maybe that's unit tests passed, tests are written, whatever is your list that you want to go through. I think that that starts really changing the culture of how teams build software, so that you can have more quality up front. The second thing is, the tech debt just happens, just as from a nature of building software. I think having continuous learning or tech debt retros as part of your cycle is really important. One of the retros I like to do is a quadrant of, you know, on the x-axis having how much effort is it, on the y-axis saying how much does it hurt. And so, you know, you can very quickly kind of sort your tech debt, so that you can figure out, you know, maybe what is some of the things that are going to be really big that we need to negotiate with product, and have some of those big conversations to get things prioritized in the backlog, and or what are the quick wins that we can do relatively quickly. The third thing that I think is really important is looking at your risky assumptions. So what I mean by that is, when you start a project, there's always some things that are really hard. Like, we'll say, you know what, I worked for a company where it was like, this page takes, it's a 10 megabyte page, and it takes a really long time to load, so we can't have a lot of traffic on it. So it's like, instead of building or architecting a design around those hard problems, what do you need to bust through so that you don't have bad design? So it's like, if that's a risky assumption that like this page is really heavy, what do we need to do to solve for that? So the team actually did that as the first step of the project and got the page down to 12K. And all of a sudden it totally changed the way that we were about to approach and build this. So again, I think that the three big things are, you know, build quality and definition of ready, retro your tech debt, and number three is solve your risky assumptions.
Can I ask a clarifying question on when you said seeking permission to lower technical debt? If did I hear that incorrectly? Is it that does the team have to seek out?
It's not permission. It's a negotiation, right? Because typically, at least in agile development, or you know, I'm sorry, in Scrum, a lot of folks are used to product owning the backlog. And so development needs to be a team effort and everybody gets a say and everybody should be able to add to the backlog, but there should definitely be a conversation and we need to be able to negotiate, especially if it's going to affect timelines or if it's seen as non-value add to the customer.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
I had one idea that is on top of all the non-technical stuff is that I recently read a book that's called Your Code as a Crime Scene. And it's really a book written to find bugs in a very specific way, more using what they call forensic techniques, using all kind of tools. And I think you can use the same thing also for finding bad designs and for finding technical depth and solving that kind of stuff. So that's on a more technical space, I think it can help as well. It's a book by Adam Thornhill from 2015 that I really, really like. It's more on a technical skill, but sometimes people don't know where to start, and this could be a good one to help out as well. Because it gives different ways of looking at your code, not just normal way of looking at your code, but really like within in forensics, because it compares a lot of the tools that were used by forensic people to find crime scenes and stuff like that. So very intriguing book, more on the technical side.
So I have a question on that. From a clarity perspective, crime scenes typically end up with a criminal. That's in there. How do you not do this where forensically or you do root cause analysis and then it always typically leads to a person, right? Or a group. How do you make sure that you don't vilify?
Yeah, that's that. He talks about that as well. But your question reminds me at some kind of joke that's sometimes spread between developers where they said, well, developing is like, You're part in a movie or an investigation and you turn out to be the murderer yourself or something like that. So it's not about the blame culture. It's not about who's at fault, but more who can change it and who can find things. And really what we're looking for in the way this is, like I said, it's more for bugs. So it's more for finding the bug than for finding who wrote the bug. But it looks at much larger patterns as well, and it's especially the larger patterns where they look at code. Okay, for example, what is the most changed module in this part? What is the thing that is most changed or recently changed a lot? And using it like that to find bugs in a different way. And so if you would see, okay, this part of the code has never changed, and thinking a completely on a pattern level at your code, so trying to avoid the blame. But I think the tool can be used to find blame, I think, or a lot of these can be, but that can be done for everything, because just with technical depth there, it's also tempting to say who made sure that this was that we now have technical depth. None of us and all of us, I think.
Right. Well, I think the psychology becomes important because I've watched many of what I would consider to be developer death marches, where big architectures in particular, where we have developers coming in and you know each module needs to be debugged in a certain order in order to figure out where the particular fault is at. And I've seen this where we bring people into the lab and, you know, suddenly the one person who's sitting there doing the debug and their face goes white, because they just discovered that they were the murderer in that case. And I think the psychology of not blaming, I think, is very important for organizations to be able to embrace in order for this. We just have to acknowledge the technical debt exists. And yes, we're all, you know, working on it. Let's see. Abhijit, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
I'm Abhijit, or you can call me Abby. I have a quick question. Like, you know, what are the biggest challenges in general that you have experienced in terms of managing technical debt, and what improvement action you have? I mean, you can advise to tackle this kind of a situation, and especially while working with the external vendors in any product development initiative.
Well, I'll take a first stab at that. I think technical debt sometimes is sort of like the iceberg analogy, which is it's the invisible thing that exists underneath that most people don't see until they start to do change to the system. And so I think the first effort in understanding what you have is measuring it. And there are multiple measurement methods. I'm not going to go into all of the different ones that you can go use, but getting an idea of what is the, say, the complexity ratio of your code is an example, you know, complexity measurements that you can do. And you know that something that's highly complex and with lots of different, you know, code branches tend to be very fragile when you go in and do change. And so that's one measurement system that you could use to just point to sections of the code or sections of your architecture that need to be refactored. And as we know, refactoring comes at a cost, but the cost should be the cost benefit. And this is the thing that, you know, always explaining to management is that if we spend, you know, half of our sprint reducing technical debt, we get to go move faster in the next sprints. So we should be able to increase our velocity. That makes sense.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Ray. Thank you so much.
No problem. Let's see. Sheila, how about you? What do you have on this?
I just wanted to point out that one of the things that I find to be very important in this regard is to make sure that if you find technical debt or you find things that don't adhere to this technical excellence, that it gets captured and it gets put into your backlog. Oftentimes people will see it and say, oh yeah, this was really bad code and, you know, I had to change this, but they didn't have time to address it, but then don't capture the fact that that piece of code really needs that refactoring. The other thing that I have seen is where developers put in technical debt in order to meet timelines and the pressure that you were talking about earlier. And at some point, those are going to be necessary and have to be done. But it's, again, really extremely important to capture the fact that you did this and to go back in and correct it at a later point. So I think that having all of those things in the backlog really helps to give that attention to the technical excellence and making sure that a certain percentage of your time is dedicated to that.
So when you say a certain percentage of time, how do you typically do the negotiation for that? How do you make sure that that occurs versus that urgency that put in the technical debt is somewhat of the culprit?
So I think that as a Scrum Master, we try to coach them to put in a percent of the capacity toward reducing technical debt if there is that backlog of technical debt. And it could be a 10%, a 20%, which is negotiated with the overall, you know, product team, that this is a very important aspect of increasing the team's productivity.
So with that, have you ever just, I don't mean to pick on you on this, but do you ever get pushback? Do you find that as someone's pushing back on you, do you have a way that you influence the entire team in that case?
I think it's a matter of having that coming from the top down, and I've been able to explain the benefit to those that are that can influence the product owners, so that the product owners understand that this amount of time has to be spent on this particular task. Without that higher level, I have found that sometimes it is difficult for the Scrum Master to say, oh, we have to put this in, because the product owner will say, well, that's not helping me. And, you know, so sometimes it depends on your product owner. And I also find that you really do need it coming from top down.
So that top-down lead, that sort of philosophy. And that, Shauna, you, in your role, do you find that top-down is important?
I think that it's really important for the team to be able to tell a good narrative. Top-down, I think a lot of times from a top-down approach, they're not always connected to the work as closely. I think that it's important. So when I say telling a good story, it's really about the narrative. And, you know, before I mentioned customer impact, so things like page load times, things like if something doesn't work correctly. So I was working on an outside problem with something like accounts or identity. And what was happening is, like, you know, it wasn't necessarily clear who people were who were signing up for accounts, and there was an issue, and it was seen as tech debt. And I think that it's like, we have to be really clear why there's an impact on the customers and how it's going to impact the product in the long run. And it's not always quote unquote tech debt. So I think if the team can do a really good story to say customer centric and look at impact even through tech debt, that will help bring a common understanding to the breadth of the problem that we're trying to solve, if that makes sense.
Okay. Sheila, your microphone came back on. What do you have?
Oh, I was just going to say one of the things that we've done, which has helped, is to rename it from technical debt to strategic technical enhancements.
Ooh, I like that.
And this has helped a lot with making it more appealing. So sometimes it's the branding.
So who wouldn't want to work on that? You know, it's like, I want to be on that team. So let's see, Karen, what do you have?
So yeah. I'm one of those new people, and I'm just trying to wrap my head around technical debt. And you said, if we spend our time creating technical debt, we'll go faster in the next sprint. But this is about, you know, technical excellence. So how do technical debt and technical excellence kind of coexist? And how does the team decide if technical debt makes sense and is worth it?
Those are good questions. So one, just to level set, technical debt is just the artifact of just potentially we skipped a few steps, we didn't refactor code, you know, the first version of my code is always the sloppiest, you know, or we didn't do an adequate amount of testing to that particular code block. Its performance, its iteries might be lower than expected. It could be done better. We all have that in our code base. The question of technical excellence would be that definition of done that we have that says that we will have a unit level test that verifies the operation of this, and we will check it for these different things. And we will repair those things and not allow that to ship to a customer. We might give them an early demo of it, of the product, but, you know, we don't consider that to be done. It's not in the definition of done. So the balancing point, I think, is that one, just acknowledging that it exists, and then how do we effectively, if we have too much of it, we know that we're going to slow down from that. Jörg, you actually were starting to speak in here. Did you want to add something to this?
Yeah, I want to add two things. First of all, to Shauna's narrative, I found it quite effective to tell the stories of what would have happened if we wouldn't have dealt with a certain kind of technical debt afterwards. And you normally only know it afterwards, but it makes a very good horror story to tell people in charge what would have happened, especially on their time and their discussion with the customer, if we hadn't tackled this one or found that kind of problem. And that actually the invest was just a day for two people, and otherwise they probably would have flown out to the customer or something like that. So when you ever have these stories, then it becomes, you capture the attention with the story because it's their story, their pain. And then with the happy ending, you get a lot of positive support. And next time when you say, I have to do something like this, because you remember you already caught these three problems in the last three sprints, you don't want to get stuck with another one, right? Then they suddenly feel the invest is much slower. And especially for the teams, it's quite a point of celebration to notice what they prevented. If they just solved a technical problem, that's just another technical problem. But if it's either customer delight or manager pain that they prevented and that gets told upwards the chain, that is as well something to really celebrate and be proud of. So it goes both ways, strengths of the team and makes the deciders more amiable to give you a free hand. And otherwise, sure, just grab some time to solve it. And with regard to technical excellence and technical debt that happened with the best people doing the best work, because there are things we only learn afterwards. And there are situations with the use of our product that change and that we were not aware of. So there's always a reason to improve or change something. And ignoring this is then the technical debt that we pay. And if you do it by intention very early, it gets even more costly. No, nobody's free of this, and it will not go away, never.
That's very true. Karen, did that help?
Yeah, I guess my original understanding of technical debt was something that, you know, kind of the easy way out, and then you're running into problems. Perhaps this is more of a finessed definition of technical debt.
It's multiple things that create technical debt. First is cutting corners, intentionally cutting corners, as you describe it. You don't do things to the completion. You skip on tests and things like this. But there's as well things that accumulate just because your code hasn't been updated to some new standard, or you haven't really checked all the new use cases against an old part of the system or things like that. So it's not always by intention that you create it. It's not free choice. It's something that very often happens. Like look a bit like a building. When you build it new, it's pretty good, but there's still a lot of things to do, and you will find things that you didn't do when you move in. The longer it stands, the more repairs and things you will have to do, or extensions or redecorations or whatever. And both effects apply, at least in my experience. Some happen just by handover between people, because that's just another philosophy. So bringing two systems together from different people might break something that nobody notices. So all that kind of stuff. So it's
Bala, are you there?
Regarding this technical debt, just I want to share that what is happening in our organization and also the agile transformation. So during the program incremental planning, I do program incremental planning on a quarterly basis. During the program incremental planning, I ask the technical managers and the technical leads to come up with what are the technical debt work that they would like to undertake in the 20% capacity of the each sprint teams. So they come up with, like, for example, upgrading to different version and migrating from one platform to another platform. So these are the couple of initiatives during the PA planning that we capture it as a feature and then develop some user stories later, and that the 20% of the capacity is consistently allocated for this technical debt so that there is no surprise or there is no immediate work that is required to be done when we are delivering for business initiatives. So that is one of the approach that I follow, and I want to get feedback from the group also whether I'm doing the right thing. Number two is actually I think one of the group member suggested about making the technical debt itself it's a strategic initiative. Now we are doing cloud migration, so I put cloud migration as a epic. So that means that I said that whatever we are doing for business equally, cloud migration also important and prioritized as, for example, as a one, because we are spending after a long time, we are spending millions of dollars in doing that cloud migration. So these are the approaches that I am following in our current agile transformation in our organization. Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to get feedback in terms of is there any other better way of doing it, or is it okay to do in this way?
Well, I think segmentation, where you've actually said that we're dedicating 20% to technical debt, especially if the team tends to gravitate towards always wanting to go do like new stuff versus the mix. So I think the 20% number, I think, is just it's interesting. I would probably say to the team, though, what do you think that the number should be for the balance? How did you come up with 20%? It was just something that you just came up with, or is it based upon what?
No, based upon actually, I read through a lot of agile practitioners, their experience, and the most of them are suggesting that instead of taking some technical work, maybe 50% in the sprint, if we consistently allocate that 15 to 20% of their time in these technical debt activities, then we gradually make sure that we address that side of things also. But so when we try to use this, whatever the upgrade or whatever new features implemented part of this technical upgrade, then we can leverage on that, and then we can demonstrate to the business that this is how it is adding value.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I think the numbers are always interesting, because 20% doesn't seem like, you know, oh, let's spend 20% on this or you know, what I found is that when we made strict allocations, that sometimes it's hard for people to fill those buckets as much. But sure. I still, you know, I think your approach is one way of doing that. Okay. Does anyone want any final thoughts on this?
One final thought, Ray, is that I feel like technical debt decreases your time to market, because getting features out or showing value quickly becomes harder. If you want to, from a planning perspective, if you want to say what is the cost if we don't do this, or how over time, how our time to market has been getting slower and slower, those are definitely big impactful metrics that you can bring to your executive team and kind of show them why solving for this and building time in for it is really important.
Awesome. Any other final thoughts?
Yeah, I had one more about avoiding the technical debt. One technique that I've seen in teams is using something and giving team to do something like you build it, you run it. So when a team, and again, it's much more complicated, but when you give a team they have to support a certain software that they're creating, when you do this, you also give them the power to say no to a release. So basically, because they know that they have to support that, then they will be called in the evening or whatever. What I've noticed is when you start to do this, is that the team will be much more careful about releasing stuff with things that they think is not good enough quality. And so that's a way to avoid these kind of things. Now, there is a lot of things about you build it, you run it. You have to be really careful that they actually do have that power and such like that. But once you set it up really correctly, then it really helps to avoid creating extra technical debt, not avoid everything, of course, because a lot of that technical that we don't know. But it was especially for, I think it was Shana who said it earlier, the things that we know that are existing and that we want to record. Well, it's even better if we can avoid it, it escapes.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Christine, do you want to have the final thought?
I have a final question.
Sure.
So we're talking about percentage of time or some spot in the backlog, maybe each sprint, to work on some technical debt. So I'm imagining, you know, a story or some percentage of time blocked with just a story header. Does the conversation change if instead of speaking in it to it in that way, would the conversation change if it was more a practice of fixing kind of around whatever code you're working on for any particular story? How would you kind of prevent a person from spending too much time? If that was the practice, then how do you limit it so they don't spend too much time?
Yeah, we've done things where we've actually time boxed, you know, things that have uncertainty to it, meaning that if you take the Fibonacci number of most technical debt, you're probably going to get a really high Fibonacci number that comes out. And the question is, what can we do within a short one-day time box and report back is what we've done. That way that even though we're constraining it to, yes, the 20% or whatever the number might be during the planning cycle, that 20% is a bit of a guess because we're going to get so far after we open the hood up, do the triage, start to go work the complexity, and then understand that we can only do so much. And so the time boxing allows us to then re-evaluate on a daily basis that what is the next step so that you don't get the whole thing pulled apart is one way of doing that. Shana, how do you deal with that?
In terms of the time, I really think that, like kind of what you said, being able to pull it apart is really important.
One of the things that I've done with teams in the past and just introduced to the current team that I'm working with is the idea that if you're in a piece of code that you're going to be in a fair amount for this sprint or for going forward, you're going to be making tweaks as you go forward. If you find something that needs to be redone or find something that can be done better, a piece of code that can be improved, check it out, make sure that you understand what it is, and then make the change and nibble away at these potential problems, nibble away at the technical debt as you're still working on the stories that you're working at, that you're engaged in.
Right.
And the trick, of course, is to make sure that the code that you're tweaking is doing precisely what you think that it's doing, so that you can run a test before and after and make sure that the behavior is the same, that you've made it better without corrupting what it does.
And I think you bring up a very important part, which is when you're starting to do any type of architectural refactoring or cleaning up, that it is surrounded by tests. I can verify that the fact that I didn't undo something that was important, that I might have just thought I cleaned it up and boy, that looks better, but now it doesn't work. So thank you for that.
And I remember what I was going to say. Okay. I think doing something that is also really inclusive of the team so that everybody can come together, you know, swarming events or doing some sort of, I like to think of it as like a mob code review where everybody comes together, you get the code up on a screen or you do it through Zoom or whatever, where everybody can kind of look and have a conversation about where the issues are, you know, and have it kind of facilitated or have it each person trade off as you're sort of doing that review. That's a really good way just to get everybody aligned on ways that you can improve.
Yeah, so I just want to add to the, you know, fixing as you go and that whole time boxing And one of the things that I've always done was to tell teams that if they find something that really needs to be, that should be refactored, where they are making changes for a story that's within the sprint, if it doesn't impact the sprint goal to make those fixes, then that should happen. But if it's going to have a major impact on the sprint goal and you think that it's going to cause that goal to be missed, then it should just be captured in the backlog.
Okay.
So that's how I deal with that.
That's good advice. Thank you for that. So with only a few minutes left, I'm going to actually pop another question, and hopefully we can go through this really fast, which is how successfully is it to apply for a job as a Scrum Master if you don't have a certificate? Shauna, I am a Scrum Master coming at you. I call myself a Scrum Master, but I don't have a certificate. Would you hire me?
Me personally, yes. I do not. I don't care as much for certificates as I do, experience or having a passion. If you've done some things on your own to sort of understand and learn, I've moved a lot of people over from parts of the org, for instance, taught them if they're coming in new, if they have some kind of experience with agile development, if they have passion for continuous learning, like those are the things for me that I look for.
Jörg, I am a uncertified Scrum Master. Would you hire me?
Yeah, I don't care for certificates or things like that in the first place. I would like to know what you've done so far, and I'd love to have you run a retrospective with my team, maybe even right off the spot to see what happens and how you do things. So for me, I definitely would have a long discussion. What's your view? What's your technical background? What you think agility means, or whether the word at all matters and things like that. So theory and practice need to go together. And a certificate is just a piece of paper which proves neither. So
okay.
To me, that doesn't matter. And I've not worked in an organization to say that had a fixed rule that you needed a certificate for anything. It's so binding. So don't get put off applying.
Abhijit, and what do you have in this?
I wish I could have been in touch with York, Shauna, and whoever, they don't care about the certification. My only wish that I would have appeared in an interview board and where Shauna and you guys were there. Because in reality, in my, very frankly speaking, I've never, ever, wherever I went, even if my resume, my CV never even picked up, because of there were no certification, like as a Scrum Master, product owner, et cetera, et cetera. And then I have to go for those certification to at least to get a chance to an interview, to speak something about Scrum, the servant leadership or product ownership, et cetera. So my experience is absolutely different. I've never been I only wish I would have lived in that part of the world where they don't judge people or select their resume in some different way.
That's a good perspective. Thank you for sharing that. John, how about yourself?
Yeah, and so kind of to both statements, I think it really depends on the company. Some people do want to see a certificate, some don't. But what I specifically look for when I'm hiring is, what have you done beyond just the certificates? I mean, one really great thing is to blog about it, to interact with the community. Because if I always Google people, and if I can't really find anything, that kind of gives me something to go on in the interview. But if I can find a lot of interactions with the Agile community, they've written a lot of blog posts, that tells me more than a certificate ever will, because you get a sense of how they think. And in the interview, you can really play off of that. So, some people find value in certificates, some don't, but you really have to go beyond.
Well, that's a good perspective. And Debbie, how about yourself?
I was going to piggyback on that same vein. I think when you're talking to somebody about and interviewing them for a Scrum Master position, regardless of whether or not they have certification or not, I've noticed that, you know, for people who have no experience that just kind of went out and read some books and figured out how to pass a test, you hear a lot of that in this regurgitation of specific words and phrases, but they don't really have a way to actually put it into a real life situation. So I agree with some of the other things that I heard. If you ask them, you know, hey, how about running a stand-up for me today? How about let's go do a real quick retro? Let's see where the team's at. Being able to think on your feet and being able to actually show what you know is way more important than the certification. However, being a person who is certified, the amount of time and effort that you have to put into keeping up that certification and doing that continuous learning and wanting to continue to do that shows a certain amount of passion for the not just the job, but the career path that you're on. And I think that's just as important. I mean, to really have that passion for it and to say, I want to learn more and I want to just like attending these coaching sessions. I mean, these are great and these are part of it. So yes. I think it's kind of, it goes both ways.
Absolutely. We are at the top of the hour. This has been a great set of conversations today. So with this, just a couple things to let you guys know. We have Deliver Agile Alive, which is going to be for Agile Alliance members. If you have an Agile Alliance membership, you're able to get into the Deliver Agile free for the remainder of its existence. We're actually now making this a member benefit to come join a group of as they go and explore different things in the technical practices space through the Deliver Agile. You guys have also asked for, and I see this on the feedback all the time, we want Lean Coffee. Guess what? We're going to start Lean Coffee up in September. So on September 29th, if you're an Agile Alliance member, you're also able to join a monthly Lean Coffee session, which is run completely different than this particular forum, because you will be able to join different tables that are on different topics, and you can basically sit and explore all the different things that you want to do in a Lean Coffee format. To find out more about this, you just go up to agilealliance.org and then go ahead and register for that event. The next ACN is going to be September, not 124, September 24th, the end of next month. I hope that you all can join us. We'll have some good fun topics then. With that, I hope that you have a great rest of your month. And thank you so much for joining us this month. This podcast is provided by Agile Alliance for educational and informative purposes only. To find out more information about the member-supported Agile Alliance, please go to agilealliance.org. to find out about more upcoming events, as well as different programs that are available to help you with your Agile journey.